The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2011 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2011. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Well, good afternoon. So you're all full of food. It's now been one talk later. Do your best to stay awake. Okay, hopefully, I'll do what I can to keep you awake. I had one student this last year, a kid named Kevin. Kevin was notorious about falling asleep in calculus or physics. It was hilarious. I mean, it was a lot of fun because I got to pick on him, but the poor kid. Well, my name is Jim Nance. I have taught at Logos School for the past 21 years. Last year and for several years, I've taught calculus, physics, logic, Bible doctrine, and classical rhetoric. So I'm a generalist, which makes it true that whenever I go to anybody else's talk, I always feel like I'm not doing enough. You know, I went to the talk on science two hours ago, and the lady there was just telling me all the different things I needed to be doing and reading, and I'm sitting there thinking, when am I going to get ready for my other classes? And maybe some of you were in that talk and felt the same way, but she's right. You know, we need to read, we need to spend time with others. It was an encouraging talk, but it was a little hard. Well, let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you very much for the things that you've taught us so far. Father, thank you for the encouragement that we've received from the different workshops and the plenary speeches. Father, pray that you would continue to encourage and teach us. Help us to follow you in all that we do and say and think. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, truth, goodness, and beauty in mathematics. Truth, goodness, and beauty are an interrelated triad of Christian norms, biblical standards, which I found to be helpful in my teaching of diverse subjects like calculus and physics and logic and rhetoric and doctrine. Beauty leads us toward truth, and truth allows us to do good, and goodness, I think, is an essential element of beauty. You know, you saw, if you weren't here earlier, the picture of the, I think it was an F-15 I had up here, and the beauty of that plane was a result of making it work right, of making it do the good that it's supposed to do. These three functions are interrelated. And that's seen in any and every subject, but I think mathematics especially shows these triune interrelationships in the clearest relief. Mathematics shows these interrelationships most clearly. Now, this has not always been acknowledged. Aristotle argued that those who assert that the mathematical sciences say nothing of the beautiful or the good are in error. And he could be talking about some of our students. They see the mathematics leads to truth, and maybe, hopefully, and that's as far as they go. Now, I want to try to show the truth of Aristotle's claim in this workshop, and I want to especially emphasize mathematical beauty. First, in mathematics, let's see how beauty can lead us to truth. When Copernicus wrote on the revolution of the heavenly spheres, he was seeking a more elegant system of planets that could save the appearances, meaning that it could account for the observations of the planets, including the sun and the moon, not including the Earth and that word planet at the time, but that it could save the appearances, meaning that it could account for all the observations of these different heavenly bodies. In his preface to Pope Paul III, Copernicus compared the existing theories of planetary motion with the 75 to 80 different circles and epicycles and so on that described how the sun and the moon and the other planets revolved around the Earth. He compared that with a monster made up of body parts, each shaped very beautifully and without reference to one body, so that such parts made up a monster. He said, in talking about other astronomers, some employ only concentric circles, others use eccentric and epicyclic ones, with which, however, they do not fully attain the desired end. They could not even discover nor compute the main thing, namely the form of the universe and the symmetry of its parts. It was with them as if some should, from different places, take hands, feet, head, and other parts of the body, which, although very beautiful, were not drawn in their proper relations, and without making them in any way correspond, should construct a monster instead of a human being. Now, this search toward elegance in a model led Copernicus to set the sun at the center of the system, to discover, or perhaps we could even say to invent, a solar system. And he wrote, "We find, therefore, under this orderly arrangement, a wonderful symmetry in the universe, and a definite relation of harmony in the motion and magnitude of the orbs, of a kind not possible to obtain in any other way. Contrary to all appearances, contrary to accepted dogma, Copernicus placed the sun at the center of the system of planets. This allowed him to significantly reduce the number of circles and epicycles. His system was more elegant, it made fewer assumptions, and thus he was convinced that it was a superior system. He was convinced that it was true. Copernicus argues for his new system because of its orderliness, its symmetry, and its harmony. His proof was not a proof saying this applies better, we can predict better, this works better. His proof was an aesthetic proof. His proof was a proof of beauty. His sense of beauty was what led him to truth. Now, Copernicus' system, plus Tycho Brahe's accurate observations, led Johannes Kepler to an even more elegant model, with the planets orbiting the sun not in circles and epicycles, which Copernicus still had, but in ellipses, the planets moving at varying speeds according to Kepler's elegant second law. Now, the beautiful elliptical orbits allowed Isaac Newton to postulate an elegant cause, his universal law of gravity. This, in turn, was modified by Einstein and so on. And we see that the pursuit of beauty, elegance, and aesthetic satisfaction led men like Copernicus and Kepler and Newton and others after them to discover truth. Beauty leads to truth. How many of you saw this article a couple weeks ago? Okay, I was attracted to it, talked about antimatter. I read it, and I want to summarize how antimatter was discovered. In 1928, the theoretical physicist Paul Dirac developed the first theory to fully account for relativity in the context of quantum mechanics. He came up with this theory, and in interpreting his theory, Dirac was led to realize the existence of what he called an anti-electron, with the same mass but opposite charge of a regular electron. Dirac was led in his mathematics by a sense of beauty. Beauty led him to find truth. He admitted that it was primarily his sense of aesthetics which encouraged him to find a more elegant equation to describe the electron. He went so far as to say it is more important to have beauty in one's equations than to have them fit experiment. Now, Dirac's theory was confirmed a few years after afterwards when the positron and later other particles of antimatter were shown to exist, and they're now trapping them for long periods of time in magnetic boxes. So again, my point here is that we see a scientist assuming that creation works in an orderly way, described by elegant mathematics, and by this assumption, he is led to discover truth. Now, the same thing can be said for pure mathematics. A Russian mathematician with this unpronounceable last name said this: "Beauty is for me a sign of the truth. When I think about a mathematical problem or theorem, my intuition suggests to me what should be true. I will see relationships between properties or results, and these relationships will suggest something new. I guess at the truth even before I know the truth. When I believe something will be true, there is usually also usually suggested to me a way to prove it. And when I try to prove it, I will sometimes... Whoa! Don't hit the buttons. Come on. I will sometimes feel things fitting together harmoniously. It is from this feeling of harmony that I know my way will work. So even in pure mathematics, beauty can lead to truth. So in mathematics, truth also allows us to do good. Now, the inverse of this is obvious. Falsehood allows people to do evil. The serpent's deception of Eve, his lie, led Eve to eat the fruit and so disobey God. Email scammers will tell you, just click right here and you'll make lots of money. Okay? Their deception leads to evil. But just as falsehood opens the door for evil, truth opens the door for good. We can use information that's true and we can benefit from it. We can use it to do good. You were all told the day that this conference would start, and because this information was true, you were able to benefit from the entire time. Our mathematical system of time is true and accurate and thus useful. Through a proper use of measurement, we can feed large numbers of people. And all of you ladies who have done great big feasts for lots of people know that you do a lot of math in making this sort of thing work. And in this increasingly technological age, the more our students learn about and understand mathematics, the more they will be able to serve others, the more they'll be enabled to serve others. We need students who understand the heavy math. So in mathematics, beauty leads to truth, and truth allows us to do good. But what do I mean by mathematical truth? That needs a little bit of unpacking. So let me unpack it a bit. I want to argue that math is true, meaning that a proper pursuit of mathematics leads us to truth. Now, you might think, like my students, that math is true is axiomatic, that it's believed by everyone. Isn't 1 plus 1 equals 2 a clear, unassailable truth? Can't the same thing be said about the square of 12 being 144, the cosine of pi being negative 1, the integral of cosine being sine, and so on? Okay, don't we all just recognize that it leads us to truth? Have not men always held mathematics up as the one science whose conclusions are certain? Did not Descartes argue that of all the sciences known as yet, arithmetic and geometry alone are free from any taint of falsity and uncertainty? Well, of course, the answer is no. Otherwise, I wouldn't be asking the question. Some modern mathematicians deny that mathematics is true at all. One clear example of this is seen in the book Mathematics, Queen and Servant of the Sciences by E.T. Bell. Bell asserts that mathematics is nothing more than a game played according to certain simple rules with meaningless marks on paper. It's a game played by rules made up by men with meaningless marks on paper. He compares math to a game of chess, which is a game played according to simple and meaningless rules, and says only a very original philosopher would dream of asking whether a particular game of chess was true. Bell assumes that mathematics is man-made, and that man is the ultimate standard of truth. And we see this clearly when later in the book he writes, suppose someone asserts that somewhere in the decimal development of pi, the sequence of digits 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 occurs. Is this assertion true? Is it false? I admit neither possibility because there is no known method of deciding. Now, what is Bell assuming here? He's assuming because man cannot know whether the statement is true or false, therefore the statement is neither true nor false. So to Bell, men develop their own rules of math, and they have the freedom to use whatever consistent set of rules they want. Therefore, math gives us no truth. Now, I agree with his premise. I agree that men develop mathematical systems. It's undeniable that they do so. I agree that they have the freedom to use whatever consistent set of rules they wish. You could go develop a new system of mathematics. People do this sort of thing. Okay? But I deny that this removes truth from mathematics. Okay? Why do I say that? Because I acknowledge the sovereign God, who for his own sovereign purposes guides men to develop mathematical systems that are consistent and applicable to the real world. God used mathematical systems invented by Euclid and Descartes and Fermat and Hardy and Bell. He used their own game playing, if you will, to lead us to truth. God reveals truth to men, including mathematical truth. So math leads us to truth because God leads us to truth through it. Now, I want to look at those two standards I mentioned there, consistency and applicability, and what I mean by them. Consistency means able to be true at the same time. The postulates, theorems, and methods and conclusions of mathematics are considered to be true in part because they're consistent with each other. We can say that they are internally true. And this is because math uses strict deduction from postulates, and any valid deduction from a statement will lead to a conclusion that's consistent with that statement. Valid conclusions are consistent with their premises. For example, if I postulate that all men are sinners, then I can deduce that I am a sinner, that you are a sinner, that George Washington was a sinner, that Adam was a sinner. These are all true statements, and they're all consistent with each other. And because I can prove billions of people are sinners from this one truth, this is a very fruitful postulate. Now, Euclid's geometry is a prime example of an internally consistent mathematical system. Euclid starts with some definitions, five postulates, and five common notions, and using strict deductive logic, he produces 48 theorems in the first 13 books, including the Pythagorean theorem, which is number 47 of 48 in his first book. And for over all 13 books, it comes up with about 500 different theorems, all deduced from those few assumptions. So logically consistent theorems from fruitful postulates led Euclid to truth. Now, Euclid's geometry was not only internally consistent, but very applicable to the real world. Euclid's geometry was considered to be the grand example of indisputable truth. His theorems are internally consistent. They've proved themselves to be very useful for thousands of years. Thus, they are very fruitful. But with the discovery of non-Euclidean geometry, Euclid's mathematical system was dethroned from its grand position of absolute truth. And I might add, rightly so. It did not hold that position rightly. Only God's word is absolute truth. Now, both Euclidean and non-Euclidean geometries are internally consistent. They're internally true. But they're inconsistent with each other. They can't both be true in the same way. For example, Euclid said that parallel lines do not meet. Some of the non-Euclidean geometries say that parallel lines do meet. Now, the odd thing is that both Euclidean and non-Euclidean geometries are very fruitful. They're applicable to the real world. And you might ask, if they contradict each other, which geometry is the real truth? My students would ask me. The answer is that all of them are true, to the extent that all of them are consistent and applicable. If the question is, okay, which geometry is the absolute truth? Then the answer is none of them, since only God's word is the absolute truth. They're consistent. They're applicable. And that's all we should ask of mathematical systems. So, mathematics can lead us to truth, but we need to be aware of what that means. Math gives us truth that is consistent with itself and consistent with what we observe about the world around us. We can use math confidently. We can use it to do good, to take a godly dominion over creation. But do not put mathematical truth on the same level as that of scriptural truth. Mathematics is, if you will, a creaturely truth in which we can have creaturely confidence, which we can use to understand creation. Mathematics is a tool for learning truth. Okay, if I've shaken your view of mathematical truth or your view of my view of mathematical truth, let me strengthen it again with a couple of examples of how mathematics has led us to truth. About a century after the death of Isaac Newton, James Maxwell had a problem. He was familiar with the four laws of electromagnetism of Gauss, Faraday, and Ampere. But he knew mathematically that these laws were inconsistent. And Maxwell noted that the addition of a new term in Ampere's law would fix this mathematical problem. And so he added the term, and that term represented a changing magnetic field. Now, in thinking about it, he realized that his correction to Ampere's law meant that a changing magnetic field creates an electrical field, and a changing electrical field creates a magnetic field, and therefore these equations allow self-sustaining electromagnetic waves to travel through empty space. He later expanded this theory and asserted to the scorn of the scientific world of his day the existence of electromagnetic waves, which nobody could see, feel, or hear. And Maxwell died before he could verify his theory. 10 years later, Heinrich Hertz discovered how to transmit these waves through space, justifying Maxwell's theory and leading to the invention of the wireless telegraph, the radio, and later the television. So, notice this. Through mathematics alone, Maxwell was able to predict the existence of undetectable radio waves. He knew that invisible, immaterial stuff was flying all around us at the speed of light, and nobody could see it, and nobody could know it in any way except through mathematics. Now, the golden ratio is another example of how mathematics has led men to applicable truth. So let me talk about that for a little while. Around 300 BC, Euclid discovered what he called the extreme and mean ratio. Okay. He asked the question, where would you cut a finite line so that the ratio of the longer side to the smaller side was the same ratio of the whole thing to the longer side, or if I can be a little bit mathematical here, where the ratio of x to y equals the ratio of x plus y to x. Well, if you solve that relationship, which is pretty easy to do, you find one of the solutions to be 1 plus the square root of 5 over 2, or 1.618033988749, and so on, which is the golden ratio, or the number phi. And it's one of my favorite numbers, that's why I memorized it that far. Okay. And phi has a lot of interesting properties, and I could talk the whole hour or longer just about that ratio. It's really, really cool, and a lot of you are familiar with it. Now, you also know, then, that Leonardo of Pisa rediscovered this value in the Fibonacci sequence, where each number is the sum of the two numbers before it. And Fibonacci, in discovering this sequence, found a sequence of numbers such that if you run it all out a long ways and divide one number by the previous number, you get a number close to phi. And in fact, if you run it out an infinite length of time, you get phi exactly. And that wasn't proven by him, it was proven by somebody else. Okay. Now, the golden ratio is a useful tool. You use a golden ratio to construct a regular pentagon. Let me show you how. So you've got this golden mean, where the ratio of the one side to the other is the ratio of 1 to phi. If you take the right-hand side and use it as the center of the circle and put your compass on the other one and draw a circle around that, and then you cut it on the other side, now the ratio is phi to 1, set the center of your circle on the left-hand side and draw the radius out to that golden cut. Then from the end to the intersection of the two circles gets you to a vertex of a regular pentagon. And that's how you construct a regular pentagon. Now, the golden ratio has many applications in art, architecture, finances, and material science, and it'd be fun to talk about those sometime. But my favorite application, personally, was when I used it to physically construct my son's helmet when he was in the play. What was the name of that play? I've got it written down here somewhere. The Phantom Tollbooth. He was the mathemagician. Of course, my son would be the mathemagician in the Phantom Tollbooth. And if you could see it, it was supposed to be a dodecahedron, which has faces that are pentagons. And so I did the golden ratio and constructed my pentagons and glued them all together and made this goofy helmet thing. By the way, just for fun, the kid on the left there, his name is Caleb Courtney. His little brother, Joel Courtney, just starred in the movie Super 8. If you saw Super 8, that's that kid's little brother. Okay. Joel Courtney was one of my logic students this last year. There, just had to talk about that. Okay, so mathematics is also a guide for doing good. Doing good means obeying God. Basic math allows us to obey the Bible. What do I mean by that? Well, to start really simply, counting. God counts the stars. Because we can count to seven, we can obey God by resting every seventh day and enjoy a needed Sabbath. We can count the number of guests in our home and make sure that everyone's given a place at the table. We can move the decimal place over and thus give a proper tithe. We need to use math properly to be fair in finances, to pay our employees their proper due, to pay our taxes in obedience to law. We can use the optimization techniques of calculus to maximize our output while minimizing our expenses, thus making good use of the resources that God has given us. The mathematical truth of the derivative allows us to do good with what God has given us. Doing good means serving others. This is the case with every lawful profession that uses math, which I would argue probably means every lawful profession. Surgeons prescribe the proper amount of general anesthetics using mathematical calculations based on body weight or body mass and size. Anyone who undergoes surgery benefits from the truth of those equations. You don't want them to be wrong. The bridges and buildings designed by architects and engineers stay up. Because the math works, we can safely walk through this conference center without fear that the roof is going to fall in on our heads. Teachers, you all use spreadsheets to calculate grades in a consistent way, and so you can be fair and equitable to your students. Spreadsheets, mathematics, helps me to do my job quickly, well, consistently, and fairly. My electrical engineering friend, Mike Adams, serves God with the Far East Broadcasting Company, beaming the gospel into closed countries and taking mobile emergency radio services to places hit by natural disasters. And the radios that he uses are indebted to the mathematics of Faraday, Maxwell, and Hertz. So let's look at another way that math is used to serve others. Recall that the definition of a prime number. A prime number is a whole number divisible only by itself and the number one. If you divide a prime number by any other number, there will be a remainder. A prime has no prime factors except itself. Now the question is, does this list go on forever? Or is there a largest prime number? Let's prove that there is no largest prime number. Okay. Let's assume that there is a largest prime number, the number P. Okay. So it goes 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19, 23, 29, 31, all the way up to the number P. Let's multiply all those prime numbers together and then add 1 to the sum. Call this new number N. Now, N is larger than P. Mathematicians would say it's at least P plus 1, so it's larger than P. Also, N has no prime factors. It can't be divided by a prime number without having a remainder of 1. Thus, N is prime, and it's larger than the so-called largest prime P. This contradicts our original assumption, therefore there is no largest prime number. Now, that is an elegant proof. I would say it's a beautiful proof. It's something so abstract and esoteric as an infinite number of prime numbers. You think, how could you possibly prove that? And you can do it in a few short sentences that are pretty easy to follow. I would call this a beautiful proof. And it's also an applicable proof, a proof that can be used to do good. Well, how could you use this proof to do good? Well, in computer security, it's essential that an attacker cannot use one key, for example, the public key, to find the value of the private key. And what I mean by that is, in order to do that, you need a one-way mathematical function. And that's a function that's easy to do in one direction, but is very difficult or impossible to reverse. Factoring prime numbers is like this. It's easy to find the factor of two large prime numbers, but finding the unique factors of a very large number is very difficult. How long would it take you to figure out what two numbers to multiply to get that number? If you're doing it by hand, it'd take you a while. Yeah? Computer would be a little faster. Some of you probably learned some techniques to make it even faster. Now, very large numbers, prime numbers, are used because the larger the prime number, the more difficult the factoring becomes. So they use numbers that big or even bigger. And so this proof is very applicable because it's helpful to know that we can always find a larger prime numbers. The more they figure, you know, the faster computers the bad guys get, the bigger prime numbers we can use, and we always have more to choose from because we know that there are an infinite number of prime numbers. So mathematics is a tool for learning truth and a guide for doing good. Math can also be seen as a palette for presenting beauty, and this has been recognized by many mathematicians. Mathematics, rightly viewed, possesses not only truth, but supreme beauty, Bertrand Russell said. The mathematician does not study pure mathematics because it is useful. He studies it because he delights in it, and he delights in it because it's beautiful. G.H. Hardy said, the mathematician's patterns, like the painter's or the poet's, must be beautiful. Beauty is the first test. There's no permanent place in this world for ugly mathematics. So I want to start with talking about visual beauty in figures. When I was a junior high student, I discovered that I could draw near-perfect circles freehand. I don't know how many of you do this, but grab a pencil like this, put your thumb down, put the pencil down, and twirl the paper around, and you can draw perfect circles freehand, or near-perfect circles freehand. And it was kind of fun as a junior high student to be able to do that. Now, that led me to the drawing of beautiful connected circles, which I did all the time. To this day, I still remember my science teacher saying, Nance, stop drawing perfect circles and get to work on your report. Now, this led me to the drawing of hexagons, and from there to figuring out some of their properties. And this led me to the study of other regular polygons. This led me to an interest in the Platonic solids, and so on and so on. My point is that even as a teenage boy, I found the objects of mathematics aesthetically pleasing. I would probably have said at the time they're fun to draw. And that appreciation of beauty led me to a spontaneous study and discovery of mathematical truth. It got me into math. Now, as a math teacher, I still find myself admiring the beauty of the curves made by certain functions and how they imitate the curves found in nature. This is out right out my back porch. And the snow there, look how it curves like that. I took a picture of it, took it into my students, showed them that, and I said, okay, guys, figure out what mathematical function produces that curve. My students, in looking through the textbook, found that it's the arc cotangent. It's very close to it. I was hoping that they would find that it's 1 plus 1 over e to the x. That's what I found, or 1 over 1 plus e to the x, but it's close. So we actually found several functions that imitated that shape. I'm also occasionally struck by the harmonious patterns that we find in equations in my calculus and physics classes. I remember the delight of discovering that trigonometric functions can be approximated by Taylor series. Okay, I enjoyed learning that with each new term, the curve, that's, you know, simply y equals x, doesn't look like it because the scales are not even on each side. And then when you added that next term in the series, you got a little bit closer. And a little bit closer each time, and I don't do it every time. But I remember thinking, isn't that cool? Two of my worlds came together. Trigonometry and algebra came flying together there. I thought, wow, you can get a sine function by things that look like algebra there. And that was just it was beautiful to me. I was also intrigued by the harmonious, and by harmonious I mean similar but different patterns between sine and cosine. Compare each term, and you can see why sine function is an odd function, and cosine function is an even function. And they were similar but different. And that just struck me as something surprising and beautiful. Now, I also can find harmonious patterns in equations in my physics class. And let me give you one simple example. You're probably familiar, if you teach physics or science, with the equations of uniform linear accelerated motion. And when I teach we derive these equations, we derive them starting with just the definition of velocity, the definition of acceleration, the definition of an average, and then those last two equations are derived from just strict deduction from the first three. And then when we look at rotational motion, I derive those three equations in the same sort of way. I start with, the definition of rotational displacement, rotational velocity, rotational acceleration. And then I tell the students now, or I either tell them or I hope that they recognize that those look really familiar. And they realize that they're parallel between the three equations on the other side, the equations of linear motion. And once they realize that similarity, I tell them, now that's going to save us some work. Because we don't have to go through the math to derive those last two. The harmonious relationship between those systems of equations allows me just to assert those last two without having to derive them. Okay, harmony or beauty leads us to truth. Okay, elegance and proofs. We've already seen what I think is the clearest example of a very elegant proof, the proof that there's no largest prime number. Elegance or beauty in proofs is a very different kind of beauty, a more austere kind of beauty. It's beauty that's seen in the economy of it. That proof was a brief proof, and it was a brief proof of a powerful concept. It's also seen in, if I can call it, the surprise of it. Once you realize the truth of it, the proof seems almost obvious, but it would have been difficult to come up with on your own. The same sort of thing is seen in my calculus class when I prove the fundamental theorem of integral calculus. I always point out to my students, and I don't run through the proof here of it, but I always point out to my students the surprising nature of it, that Newton had to be very creative the way he added zero. And I know that may sound strange to some of you, but that's what he did in order to prove the fundamental theorem of integral calculus. He had to be creative, but once you see it, you go, oh, I see it. And there's some beauty and surprise to the development of that theorem. And I think, you know, just the beauty of the integral from a to b of f of x dx equals the antiderivative of b minus the antiderivative of a. There's just something really cool about that. And I hope my students see that as well. Okay. My point here is, one of my points here is, don't shortchange your students when it comes to proofs. Proofs not only help them see some of the beauty of math in a different kind of a way, but they're also important in teaching the students how to think on their own and lead them through proofs. They need it. It teaches them how to reason on their own, and that's one of the things that we're trying to do as classical educators. Okay, complex numbers are another excellent example of beauty in math and how that beauty can lead us to truth. Now, recall that the square root of negative 1 is called an imaginary number, or the number I. Now, a complex number is the sum of a real number plus an imaginary number, like 5 plus 3 times the square root of negative 1, or 5 plus 3i, or in general, a plus bi, where a and b are real numbers. Now, following certain rules, complex numbers have all the usual operations of what we've called regular numbers, or the real numbers. You can add them, subtract them, multiply them, divide them. You can find the roots of them if you want to. And it's the roots of them that I really want to look at here. It's really interesting how to find the roots of numbers. Now, to explain that, let me explain what I mean. Real numbers are found on the real number line, like the number 3 there. You can put imaginary numbers on the imaginary axis, like the number 2i there, 2 times the square root of negative 1. Complex numbers would go on what's called the complex plane now. And so a complex number no longer fitting on a number line, we now have them up on a plane, like 3 plus 2i there. It's really interesting. Of course, the next question a lot of students would ask is there a complex cube? And it's really interesting to answer, no, you know, you don't need anything. Complex plane takes care of it all, but that's beside the point. Okay, now, how do we use this to find the roots of complex numbers? Okay, let me ask you a question. If x squared equals 1, what does x equal, class? Yeah, plus or minus 1. Heard that, plus or minus 1. Good job. Okay, it equals 1 equals negative 1. Okay, if x to the 4th equals 1, then what does x equal? Yeah, good. Plus or minus 1 and plus or minus I. Square root of negative 1 times the square root of negative 1 is negative 1. Square that and you get positive 1. And so you need I, and same thing with negative square root of negative 1. Multiply by itself 4 times and you get 1. Now the really interesting thing here is that those 4 points lie on the vertex of a regular polygon, a regular four-gon, which most people call a square, or a diamond in this case. Okay? Now that truth can be very useful. That, what I would call beautiful truth, is very useful in finding the roots of numbers. If x cubed equals 1, then x equals what? Well, you know it equals 1, but it equals more than 1, because I can draw that triangle and find the locations of those vertices. X also equals negative 1 half plus or minus the square root 3 over 2 times I. Multiply that crazy thing by itself 3 times, and sure enough, you're going to get 1, because those lie on the vertices of that equilateral three-gon. That beauty leads us to truth. Same sort of thing about x to the 6th equals 1. If you know that one of the answers is 1, then you can draw that hexagon, and you can find the location of those vertices, and you can find all sixth roots of the number one. Beauty is leading us to truth. I just think that's really cool. Now, conic sections are my final example of how beauty leads us to truth. The conic sections are shapes that can be produced by intersecting a plane with an infinitely large double cone. And you've all seen that, how you slice the cone to make the circle, tilt it a little bit and you make an ellipse, tilt it a little farther and make a parabola, tilt it even farther and you get the hyperbola. Now, the conic sections were studied intensely by the Greeks, most extensively by Apollonius of Perga around 200 BC. And I would argue that Apollonius did not study the conic sections because they were useful or they were practical, but because it was aesthetically satisfying. He was having fun with the math. Now, the Greek scholars knew all about the properties of these different shapes. But these properties were only fully applied, or more applied, when men like Kepler discovered that planets follow elliptical orbits, although Venus is almost an absolute perfect circle. And they knew that some comets followed a parabolic path. And astronomers know that stars that pass closely can follow a hyperbolic path. These are, in fact, all called Kepler orbits. Now, once again, we see that mathematical beauty led men, even after thousands of years, to applicable truth, which brings us full circle. Yes, pun intended, sorry. Okay, so truth, goodness, and beauty. These standards can be seen in any and all truths that are studied in our schools if we look for them. As teachers, we should appeal to these standards in our lessons when appropriate. They're helpful even at the very mundane level of my teaching my math students. You get students, you ever get the student that asks this, "Mr. Nance, why do I have to simplify my answer? Isn't it enough just to be correct? Can't I get full credit for being correct?" And the answer is no. Yeah, being correct is necessary, but it's not sufficient. The answers should be as elegant as possible. We simplify our answers not only to make them pretty, but to make the answers more beautiful. It's easier to apply a simplified equation than a very complex equation that happens to be equal to it. And so we simplify equations in part so that we can use them, so that other people can use them. The beauty of the simplified equation allows people to do good. But notice what we have there. The standards of truth, goodness, and beauty in a mundane thing like, why should we simplify our answers? So truth, goodness, and beauty are everywhere. And I think we especially see them in mathematics. And we should point them out to our students because we want our students to see the truth of God, the goodness of God, the beauty of God in mathematics. Thank you. Wow, that went a lot faster than I thought it would.
When you're talking about the simplifying the answer, I think I need to explain what the difference is. It's compared to a quadrilateral. A four-sided quadrilateral has four equal sides, four right angles. We don't call it a regular quadrilateral. We call it, well, up to today, I used to call it a square. But anyway, I say, you use the most accurate term possible.
Right.
The most accurate term possible to describe that is a square.
Right. Right. Well, and what do you mean by accurate there? I mean, isn't 6/8 as accurate as 3/4? Why not? Well, okay. So are you saying that accurate means the exact same as simplified? Or is there a difference between accurate and simplified? Okay, I'm sorry. I'm being a logic teacher here and challenging my students. Oh, yeah. You're right. Oh, man. Put up those walls between the classes. Absolutely. Sorry. Okay, other questions? Yes, sir.
Could you say that a particular form of geometry were absolutely true if God actually used that one as the pattern for the universe? Because anyone who's had a boundary.
Okay, that's a great question. The question is, could we say that a particular form of geometry is absolutely true if it's the form of geometry that God used to design the universe? It's a very insightful question, because I think it's amazing, the more we look into the universe and the design of the universe, the more we see that we need math to describe it, and it seems like we discovered just enough math to describe it to just the amount that we need at the time. And we discover a little bit harder kinds of mathematics, Hilbert space and so on. And we use that, and we find out that this mathematics we look at actually can be used to describe the universe in a little bit more accurate way. And it gets harder and harder and harder, and you get a little bit more and more close to describing actual space. If it's the math that God used to design the universe, then I'd have to say, yeah, it's absolute truth. I don't think I'd get away with that. Absolutely. Sorry. But I think we wouldn't know that until the next life. I'm not even sure we'll know it then. You wonder about, heaven. We'll have eternity to talk about these things. At least I would talk about these things for eternity. Probably be hell for my students and heaven for me. Sorry. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, well, we are discovering math, but even there, I think we need to be careful, because can we discover inconsistent things that are both equally true? Don't we invent things that are inconsistent with each other? Yeah. That's why I prefer to use invent when it comes to things like that. At the same time, I recognize that mathematics is not man-made. Mathematics is discovered. When they first discovered, the fractals, and all the beauty of fractals. You can't help but get the idea, take this simple equation and get this beautiful thing, that the people that first looked at it were discovering something new. And they didn't come up with that beautiful pattern. It was just there, inherent in the equation. So, yeah, to that extent, absolutely, we discover things in mathematics. But it is possible to, and people really do develop mathematical systems that are inconsistent with each other, and yet consistent within itself and applicable to the world in its own unique way. There's complexities here that are really interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Good. That's an elegant way of what I was trying to say there at the end, and probably not very well. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it really is interesting looking at. Reading books about math and science by unbelieving mathematicians and thinking unbelieving mathematicians and what they realize. Read Mathematics, A Search for Knowledge by Morris Klein, or Mathematics, I should know this book. I've read it. I've suggested it so many times. So it's one where he's arguing that the mathematics has been a major cultural influence throughout the years. Help me out, Phil. I can't think of the name of this book by Klein. Anyways, there was another one by a physicist named Paul Davies. I think he's a physicist. Paul Davies wrote a book called The Mind of God. And Davies starts out at the beginning of this book saying, I don't believe in a God. I'd rather not believe in God. I'd rather believe that everything is simply explainable through math and science. And then he goes in talking about the design of the physical world. And at the end of the book, he says, but I just can't help it. He says, I can't help but believe that men were designed, that the universe was designed for them, and that there's something greater. And what leads me to that inevitably is the mathematics of the physical world. And why is it that the world can be described mathematically? That's not logically necessary, that the world can be described mathematically. But it's true. It's true that the counter-rotating spirals on the phyllotaxis of sunflowers are always successive numbers in the Fibonacci sequence. Why? They don't have to be. There's nothing essential about that, but they are. God has used mathematics to make this world, and we discover it. And it's fascinating. So, yeah, let me tell you what everybody else is telling you here. Read a lot of books. But don't be afraid to read books by unbelieving mathematicians, because you'll see them coming up against God's world and flailing. You see Morris Klein ask the question, why is it that mathematics is so applicable to the real world? And he says, Christians used to explain that by saying that God created the world and God created man, and he created the mind of man such that he was able to discover the mathematics in the physical world, and so on and so on. He outlines the Christian worldview eloquently. And then he says, but we know that God doesn't exist. He rejects it. And then he starts saying, it's a great mystery. And that's as far as he gets. And I think it's insightful for Christians to see thinking mathematicians flailing with their presuppositions. Other questions? So what would I say to a student who argues that mathematics is not beautiful, mathematics takes the beauty out of things by reducing them to an equation? Yeah. No, it doesn't. It's a great question. Who has a good answer for that? I'm sorry, I don't have a really good answer for that. Yeah, I guess you have to point out the fact that you'd have to point out what they know deep down inside without admitting it, is that it really is orderliness, harmony, symmetry that make things beautiful. When you look at music or listen to music and strict harmony, what we always call harmony in music, it's because two notes harmonize because they're a nice neat fraction. Nice, neat ratio in relation to each other. Now, if then you have a student saying, don't tell me that, it removes the beauty of the music. I just like listening to the music. I would tell them that, it's fine to enjoy the music. It's fine to enjoy the beauty of the things. But we've got to be thinking Christians. We've got to think deeper, and we've got to recognize what's true about the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. If you simply reduce it to the math and then you leave God's world alone and only look at the math, you're definitely losing something. Write a poem about the snowdrift. Absolutely. Something I'm constantly telling my son when, he's the kind of boy he's always wanting to be the one that's right. And if anybody's different from him, they're wrong. And I always tell him, Josiah, let people be who they are. Different people are going to enjoy different things in different ways. I'm going to enjoy seeing that that's an arc cotangent function. Someone else is going to enjoy it in a different way, and that's fine. Let people be different. It's okay. God's made us all different. But I like the note that God himself is complex, and I think mathematics shows some of the both simplicity, if we can use that technical word, and complexity in the nature of God himself. God is triune. I think it's really interesting that we spend a year of mathematics looking at three-sided figures. There's something there that's really cool. And then another year looking at the mathematics of infinite stuff. Yeah, something in there. Yeah, it's one more tool we can use to appreciate things. Yeah, absolutely. Phil, do you have a question or comment? I don't name it Occam's razor, the idea that the simplest explanation is usually the best. I bring up that idea. I don't think I mentioned Occam only because I every time it comes up, I seem to doubt myself and think, am I remembering the right guy? But yeah, I certainly talked about the concept. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much. No.
Okay.
It sounds like a good book. Yeah.